Good morning. You're listening to Conservation Corner on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm Emily Nelson, and today's episode will feature an interview between Lake County SWCD's Darren Lilja, the Outreach Coordinator in the Rainy River Headwaters, based out of Ely, and Jason Butcher of the Forest Service. Now to that interview.
All right, this is a Lake County SWCD's Conservation Corner. I'm Darren Lilja, and I'm here today with Forest Service Fisheries Biologist Jason Butcher. Say hi, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jason's also my boss, full disclaimer. So I'm going to be asking a lot of questions about the way the Forest Service conducts its business in northeastern Minnesota. Kind of tongue-in-cheek, because I also work for the Forest Service. So,
well, you can help me out with some of the answers then. That'll be good.
All right, let's start with kind of the big picture. Why does the Forest Service care about water?
Sure. Well, besides, you know, the timber resource that we manage on the Superior and nationally, the one of the really big roles of the forests is clean water. And I don't know all the statistics off the top of my head, but the water that flows off of national forest land is a large percentage of what we need as far as water resources in the nation. And so it's important. The forest function is not only to provide resources like timber or recreation, but also to provide clean water. And forests do, intact and resilient forests do that in a really healthy way and give us a lot of clean water. On the Superior National Forest, we are blessed with a lot of water compared to a lot of other forests in the region and in nationally. So the forest has about half of the total water acres in the region, which our region is Region 9 in the Forest Service, and it spans from Minnesota all the way to the eastern seaboard and then down to Virginia and across to Missouri. So we have like 14-15 forests, and we have about half of all the water that flows off of all those forests. So it's particularly important for the Superior to manage their water.
So given all that water to manage, how is the water / fisheries program structured on the Superior National Forest?
Sure. So the Forest Service doesn't do a ton of fish stuff or anything like that. The DNR does a lot of, the Department of Natural Resources does a lot of the managing for fishing and fisheries. Our role is a little different. It's water quality, it's habitat, it's providing all the components you need to have a good fishery. And so that's kind of how what our role is in the overall management on our lands and state lands and everything else. So within the Forest Service, we're part of a larger group of kind of interdisciplinary folks. So I get to, the neat part of my job and folks that work with the Forest Service is that there's a lot of different specialists that I get to work with. I get to work with silviculturalists and timber folks and fire folks and soils people and wetlands people and recreation people and transportation and engineering people. And so we come together as a group to manage all the Forest Service lands and administer all we do. And so there's two main components of our program. I would say that the environmental assurance and assessment, the NEPA, and NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. And anything we do has to go through this type of analysis to make sure it's there's a disclosure of any effects to all those various resources I just mentioned. And so we all come together as a team to understand what our actions and how those will affect the overall Forest Service land. And we make decisions based on the best information we have. And so that's one part of the fisheries program, is taking part in that interdisciplinary management of resources on the forest. The other part is that we implement projects, and those are to improve habitat for fish, they're to improve water quality, they're to kind of restore the resilience of aquatic communities, and to just have more intact aquatic system. And so that's also, that's probably the other part of what we do on the forest.
So Jason, the Forest Service keeps tabs on how the timber harvests that happen on the forest might affect the streams on the forest. How do they do that, and what are they looking for?
So when we monitor any activity on the forest that's close to water, whether it's a timber harvest or a big recreation project or anything else, we try to look at kind of the whole system and things that indicate that the system is functioning properly or is something has changed. And so we try to kind of follow the, not necessarily the nuts and bolts of like the Clean Water Act, but kind of the general premise is to understand, to maintain and improve the integrity of the physical, chemical, and biological components of the stream, so, or water body. And so those three things are what we try to focus on monitoring. So physical would be things like the vessel that is the stream, the cross section, if you will, or what the stream looks like longitudinally, what makes up the stream, how much wood is in it, what the makeup of the substrate or the bottom of the stream is, if it's all cobble or sand or gravel or silt or muck. And then we look at chemical things like dissolved oxygen, different chemical components in the water, whether they're nutrients like phosphorus or nitrates, things like that. So that'd be the chemical. And then the biological is the fish and the invertebrates, the small bugs, if you will, in the stream. Now, we don't look at all of those things all the time, all over, but we know that some of those, the physical, chemical, and biological aspects of streams can tell us a lot about what's going on in the watershed. So usually for a timber harvest, what we'll do is, first of all, try to find one that's close to water, which is hard, and that's a good thing, right? We want to make sure that most of the time, the best thing to do is just maybe stay away from the water. So we have these best management practices in place when we design and implement these timber harvests that pretty much stay away from water. So we look for harvest units that end up being close to water for whatever reason, but they're still, we maintain a buffer no matter what, and follow best management practices. So when we do find a unit or two that are upstream, we'll set up a reach and then we'll look at it for these three or four components.
So when you're monitoring a stream, what biological factors would you be looking at, and what might be a red flag versus a pristine environment?
Mm-hmm. So what we use are these tools called IBIs, and they're called that's short for Index of Biotic Integrity. And different states use them, and they're basically indexes. So what you do is look for different components of the biological communities. And they're usually a bunch of things kind of mashed together, a bunch of different measures of what's in the stream. And then you kind of add those measures up for an overall score that can indicate whether it's a healthy system or not. And those are based on areas that we know are reference conditions. They're not necessarily pristine, but they are areas that we know represent the full range of biological expectations in an area. So like on the Superior National Forest, we know what the IBI scores are on average. And then we look at a particular stream based in that, or within that context. I don't know if that makes sense, but we use these IBIs, and they're developed by the Pollution Control Agency in Minnesota. They're good tools, and we partner with the PCA to, you know, kind of use their methodology for what they think is the best way to measure stream health. The components of those IBIs are usually based on some structure or function or condition of, we'll just use fish for an example. So there's a fish IBI. It's made up of different metrics, which is maybe, you know, 8 to 10 different metrics. one of those things is just plain diversity. How many critters are in a stream? How many different critters are in a stream? How many different fish? The other is more of abundance. If you have a bunch of suckers versus a bunch of brook trout, is that good or bad? And then there's the functional metrics or that make up this score. And the function is things like, how do the different groups of fish live and use that habitat? Like some fish use gravel to spawn, and so that would indicate that you have a stream with good gravel and spawning. Oh, that group of fish functionally is called simple lithophiles, so they like gravel. And so you can look at that as a measure of quality. And so all those measures, whether they're structural or functional or condition, like do you have a bunch of deformities or things like that, that would be kind of a metric that you would put into this overall index. And it gives you an idea of what the health is based on a larger set of streams that you've looked at. And if that needle moves before and after a timber harvest, then you can assume or correlate that with that timber harvest. And you can at least understand what happened there and why it happened and what the cause and effects were.
Do we ever have problems with timber harvest on the forest affecting our water?
I think that we have some local disturbance. I don't see any large scale, even at a reach level, like even a piece of stream that's 300 meters long. I don't see effects that are long lasting or would cause any concern to change the way we do things. So an example of that is there might be some erosion on a piece of stream. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's bad. There may be a change in the fish community on a certain section of stream. That doesn't always mean that the whole thing is going to unravel or not recover or get to it as the same spot it was at before. And so I think everything that we do on the forest as far as timber harvest is concerned is really interactive and healthy in a way that, we interact with folks we work with that are doing or performing these harvests, and we know we're watching and they're watching, and I think overall things are pretty sound. I think we do a good job, and we probably monitor at the intensity we need to pick up any ill effects, and we haven't seen any of those.
So can you talk a little bit more about the physical forest itself and kind of how it's divided up?
Sure. Yeah. So the forest is about 3 million acres. About a million of that is the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The rest of it is not all the same. There's some, different management focus on different areas of land. But in general, the wilderness is managed for wilderness, and the non-wilderness is managed for a lot of other stuff, different non-wilderness recreation and transportation and timber harvest and riparian emphasis areas. There's a lot of different management areas outside the wilderness. There's 5 districts and then the supervisor's office here in Duluth. The forest water-wise is divided up into 2 main drainages, the Lake Superior drainage. That's about a third of the forest. And the other two-thirds goes to the Hudson Bay via the Rainy River headwaters. And so 2 big drainage areas, all kind of headwaters. And again, about 3 million acres, a million of that's wilderness. So that's kind of how I divide it up in my head.
I'd just like to remind everyone, you're listening to Conservation Corner on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. Now back to the conversation between Lake County SWCD's Darren Lilja and Jason Butcher of the Forest Service.
So when we're setting up a station to be monitored biologically, kind of give me the start to finish on what we're doing there and how that feeds into the national discussion.
So when it starts at a desk, basically, and it starts with those bigger projects that we do, where there would be some timber harvest included in those, sets up a unit or a group of stands that gets harvested. And so we know kind of sort of when we're going to be where or when contracts are going to get let out and there's going to be a harvest activity. And we try to keep touch with our timber folks to figure out which of those is sold. And then we try to figure out where to go after that. And so it's kind of a moving target, but we try to set these up downstream of a timber harvest. And there'll be a 300 or 400 yard reach on average. And we set up a monitoring reach by length. And then we'll use an electrofisher, a backpack one usually. It fits on your back and you shock fish through that reach and kind of tally them up. And that's the end of the sort of field thing for fish. For invertebrates or aquatic insects, you partition that piece of reach off and sample according to how much and what type of habitat is there. So you use basically a small net and gather the insects in that in a kind of a systematic way. And then you take a bucket of bugs back to the lab, and we pay someone to go through those and identify them all. So at the end of the day, or multiple days, I guess, you have a list of how many and what kinds of fish, and you have a list of how many and what kinds of bugs in that stream. You'll do that a couple times or three times, maybe even before there's a timber harvest upstream. And then hopefully that sale gets sold and they do what they need to do for that resource. And then you get to come back and try to monitor two or three times after that. So it's a long-term process, but that's how we would do it in the field, I guess, set it up.
So you would go in and monitor beforehand because you want to set up a baseline.
Correct. Yep.
Figure out what's there before any potential impacts, and so you know what it should look like after.
Right. In a lot of places, it's harder to correlate what you've done to what you're finding in the stream. But here on the forest, there's not a lot else going on besides what we're doing on the land. And so that's a really good opportunity to learn and more directly tie responses to potential timber harvest or whatever you're doing. So that's a good thing to reduce all that noise in the data.
So let's say you go in and you monitor this stream and it's great water, you know, hard bottom, rocky bottom, and it's full of brook trout. And then timber harvest happens and a year later, you get in there and monitor it, and it's full of silt, and there's nothing but white suckers and mud minnows in there. What do you do next?
Sure. Well, I haven't seen that happen, but if it did, we would first of all put it in context and understand we're looking at 300 meters downstream of a timber harvest. We would want to understand what's going on the rest of it, how far that potential impact goes downstream. We'd want to look at, you know, real close ties to where that went wrong and learn from it. But also then we would try to restore any sort of damage. And you can do that in different ways depending on what went wrong. If it's a sediment thing, you would, you know, stop the source of sediment. You would replant, you'd mulch, you'd do some things along the stream corridor to prevent further erosion. And then you would, if it happens to be that there was some big flood or pulse in there, you have to look at some of the other things that may have impacted it other than timber harvest. But if there's, you know, visually some problems there, you just go fix them. And that, with a little time, will help that stream recover. And the nice thing about timber harvest and that type of activity is that's one part of a larger system. And so you'll have, if you have streams that are well connected to their watershed, you don't have a lot of fish passage barriers at roads, which is why we pay attention to those. Those things will work themselves out. That sediment in some form is meant to go through the system. It's, you know, stream movement and the movement of water and sediment is a normal function of the streams. And so it's when it gets inundated that it's a problem. And so if you see that, know that it'll work through the system, and then that it'll, if it's in a resilient setting in a healthy watershed, it'll improve through time as long as you've stopped that source. So that's what we probably do.
In the end, the stream wins.
Sure.
The Superior National Forest has some aquatic invasive species, doesn't it?
It does. We're not immune to that, of course, and that's another place that partners really play in, how to manage invasives, how to just be well-informed, just in general, like all agencies, all hands on deck sort of thing. We don't have a huge invasive problem, but it also isn't something you really want to mess with. So we have rusty crayfish, which are a concern, and spiny water flea, which are a concern. Zebra mussels kind of knocking on the door in the forest, and some aquatic invasive plants, and lots of terrestrial stuff that I don't deal with, but we have folks here that do, and thankfully they do.
Where are most of our aquatic invasive species coming from?
Well, it depends on the species and depends on who you talk to sometimes, but I think like our rusty crayfish, those are native to the Ohio River Valley, and they most likely got here from fishermen or fisher people, I guess. And so they use crayfish for bait, and all of a sudden these crayfish are there and have a good go at a new area. They have some advantages to the native crayfish, and then you have this big boom of rusties kind of spreading through. So initially I think they got here from that, and then they kind of spread on their own too and get spread additionally with people using them for bait, transferring them between water bodies. So that's the rusty, but then the spiny water flea came in from the Caspian area of Europe, and now it gets in the Great Lakes, and then it hops into inland lakes, riding, hitchhiking kind of on boats and bilge water and stuff, and downrigger cables. And so every one, the dispersal and the spread is different, but it's really important to understand how that can inform how you manage against some of these critters.
You see any patterns as far as what kind of lakes the spiny water fleas are getting into? And kind of a timeline? Are they coming from Lake Superior and moving inward or to a certain kind of lake?
I think that those kind of the lake trout lakes are important for spiny, at least on our forest. Now, they can hang out almost anywhere. Like Island Lake has a lot of spinies and probably came in from a boat. And it's not a big, deep, cold lake, but it has spinies in it, and that whole system now has spinies in it, the Cloquet River area. But then I think more commonly we have them in some of the lakes along the Gunflint and some of the lakes that you would use downriggers in. So that indicates to me anyway that they're coming in through that type of recreation potentially. And so that's where I look, and you do too, to survey for these types of lakes where that might occur.
How do you look for spiny water fleas?
I usually have you do it, but you can use a plankton net, which is just a net that's shaped like a cone. It's got a pretty, for a plankton net, it's got big mesh size, so it only catches these bigger spiny water flea. And you drag that through the water basically at the right time of year, and you can catch them. You can also use lines and things like that.
All right, Jason, can you talk a little bit about how the water and fish programs on the Superior National Forest are staffed?
Sure. So I work in the supervisor's office here in Duluth, and we have folks that work here and on the districts for water resource, kind of in the water resource group or the wet shop, I guess. And so we have a fisheries biologist here myself that kind of manages the fish part of the program, and then a hydrologist here in the supervisor's office in Duluth that manages the hydro program and those, that budget and things. And then we have a hydrologist in Ely, and Darren works in Ely as a fish and hydro tech, and we have another hydro tech in Ely, and we have a fisheries biologist in Grand Marais. And forgive me if I forgot anybody, but I think that's our shop, right, Darren?
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. So it's not a lot of people and it's a lot of water, but the good thing is I think we've done a good job in the past, and so managing that isn't too bad. We rely on other specialists and we keep just doing good work. And there's not a lot that's unraveling or broken on the forest that we need to run around and put Band-Aids on. That helps a lot. Other forests, we'll have a hydrologist on every district. So, you know, five hydrologists on the forest or something. We don't have that, and we, you know, maybe don't need that. So that's our shop, for better or worse. And then we also rely on our partners, like Pollution Control Agency has a lot of good folks that are running around doing watershed assessments and more of a state level, but strategically we communicate with them when they're up in our neck of the woods, and we use their data and they use ours. And the DNR does a great job managing the fisheries for the fishing public and administering permits and things like that. So we don't do it all anyway. We really rely on our partners and the other systems and agencies in place that they fulfill their mission, so we can do our thing too.
So how do you think the history of managing the water and fish on the forest has changed over the years? This forest been here since, when was it established?
1909, maybe?
Yeah. I know you've been here, and you've been here since...
I've been here since 2000, so not that long.
So you haven't seen that much change, but...
There's been a little bit, I guess, but it's all been more recognition, I guess, for water and the role that the Forest Service plays in freshwater management or just maintaining and having fresh water. I think that's probably the big... I don't know that it's a big change. It's just a recognition that, yeah, that forests really are important for water quality, and that's just not lip service. That's being managed on a day-to-day basis. That would be it's a good change. But other programs, including ours, you know, wax and wane, they go big, they go small. They have different components depending on who thinks what's important at the time. We focus a lot on fish passage and riparian planting and things like that, removing barriers to resilience. And so your watershed functions a way better, and it's way more healthy if you don't have a lot of stuff in the way for it, like old dams or bad road crossings or things. So we really focus on, you know, again, not just catching brook trout or not just having water that you can drink out of a lake. But having that forest and managing that forest in a way that's gonna maintain itself through time, that maybe is another change. We went away from that managing fish to just managing watersheds, I guess. And that, again, that's a good change.
That wrapped up their conversation. Thank you all for tuning in to Conservation Corner here on 99.5 FM, KTWH LP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. Conservation Corner is produced by Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District with funding from NOAA and the Office for Coastal Management, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm Emily Nelson, and I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.